Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You are listening to The Sound of London. This is London Estelle Loud. I'm Anne Quentin Wolfe. And from last week's show about food cycling, we're really moving to the sharp front end of the food business this week. What's the trick to surviving and flourishing in one of London's most competitive commercial areas? How can you turn a two-person startup into a bricks-and-mortar establishment? And how important is reputation? Our adventure starts, as many adventures have done, with a meeting in Soho Square.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds. You ain't never seen the like before, just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, step out of me, see a piece of the air, land in the sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, hello, listener. We're in Soho Square, basking in Mock Tudor sunshine. And my Mock Tudor guest is Michelle Francis.
I'm not wearing Mock Tudor outfit, though. I wasn't briefed.
That's a shame, really. It never occurred to me to do fancy. It's not going to, fancy dress is not going to work on the radio, but it's not worth doing.
Yeah, yeah, it's not an auditory thing, really, is it?
The real Mock Tudor, can you have real Mock Tudor? Here is, in front of us, the famous Mock Tudor shed in the middle of the square here.
Well, Quentin, hello everyone. We are in Soho Square, in the centre of Soho Square, and we're about to embark on a Soho food walk. And we start the Soho food walk in Soho Square, which today is just absolutely littered with people and basking in sunshine. So it's really rather beautiful. But one of the things that I wanted to point out, which is not food related at all, but before we start off on our walk, is the Mock Tudor It's the caretaker's cottage.
And this is the grandest caretaker's cottage, apart from the one in Trafalgar Square, which is not grand, but odd.
Yeah, it is rather odd. Yes, I do know.
But this
one
is something quite special.
It sure is. So it is very Mock Tudor, but it isn't of the Tudor era. But one thing that people are probably not that aware of is that underneath there is an air raid bomb shelter.
Is there really?
So that's where, during the Second World War, it was rapidly built. And there's actually a huge area. It's about 3,500 square feet.
Can we compare that to the square itself?
Probably take up about a third of the square. It's actually really controversial at the moment. I haven't actually heard any progress on this, but last year in January, Westminster City Council suggested that they would put it up for sale. The actual air raid shelter. They would put it out to tender, and there are a lot of, the reason that I'm including it is because there's a food element to it. There are a lot of restaurants that were interested in bidding on that. So they wouldn't get access to the above ground Mock Tudor cottage, but they would get access to the air raid shelter downstairs, and the fit out would probably be several million, but that's just in the process of being sorted at the moment.
That sounds like a great idea. Mm. Or a thumping nightclub.
Yeah, yeah.
There.
I think they ruled out thumping nightclub.
Oh, dear, really?
And bars, etc. But yeah, food
seems in
possibly.
Keeping with the area.
Yeah, I agree. Or the other option was for a gymnasium, so that would be more helpful for some of the muscle merry gym bunnies around here.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I would quite like to see all of the people who could fit into the area below going into that tiny building, and it would look like a 70s comedy sketch.
Yeah, a bit Monty Python, I think. So,
why did that? Do you happen to know why? Mm-hmm. It's done in this mock Tudor style. When was this put up?
So it was in the 1800s, and prior to that, this actual square was called King's Square, and it was given to, the whole area of Soho was actually given to one of King Charles II's illegitimate sons, James Scott, who was the Duke of Monmouth. Now, history isn't my area, food is my area, but I just give a bit of general sort of background.
Well, Duke of Monmouth didn't do terribly well.
No, he did not do terribly well at all, and he did okay from a property development point of view, given the Great Fire of London, and a lot of people were looking for sort of rehousing. But yes, his
from a staying alive point of view, he didn't.
Exactly, his fortunes ended very badly, and there was a statue of King Charles II that was located in the centre, and it really was the landowners in the sort of 1800s who then gathered together, rallied together and put in to create I guess it was a monument to him. And then some decades later, the pollution actually eroded a lot of that sculpture, and they decided to put this up. And really, who knows what the thinking was at that stage, because
I don't feel enlightened there at all.
No, you're not enlightened, because I'm not enlightened, but yeah, it's one of those perplexing things, really.
Well, I like its out of placeness very much indeed. Mm. And we're here, well, it's the epicentre of gastronomy. Just on the way up to see here, I've walked past all the banjos and keyboards of Denmark Street, and just as I was entering Soho Square, there was a lovely aroma, really complex, sophisticated fragrance being emitted by that building over there. House of Charity.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a dining establishment. It looks like fine dining as I glance through the window.
It is, but it's a members club. Mm. So it's not really open to everyone. But yeah, they do occasionally have open days there, and the food is quite good, but it's not included on our walk because it's not that democratic. It's not open to all and sundry. But we might get going on our walk.
Yeah, let's do
perhaps.
That.
The thing with this walk is it's not so much historical as really focusing on contemporary eating in Soho. So, you know, what's hot at the moment? What are the influences? Where have things come from and where are they heading to?
Can I check your credentials at this point? How do you keep your finger on the pulse?
One does need to verify that. I am actually a chef by background. I had a restaurant in Australia. You can probably tell that my accent is not particularly pure posh British. I've lived in London for about 6 years now, and I also run a supper club. So I sort of keep my finger on the pulse through those different various sort of foodie associations.
So you're running into a lot of people as well who are keen on their food and they know what's good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a passion of mine. So I think the thing is, when it is a passion, it's what you look for. So when I'm on Twitter, I want food updates. When I'm Instagram, I want food updates. You know, hot dinners is my Bible, you know, just to know what's going on. We might just stop here for a brief minute, Quinton, and I know that the listeners won't be able to see what we're seeing. We're actually...
Are you sure? They're very perceptive.
Yeah. You've got a hidden camera here somewhere, haven't you? And I haven't done my hair.
You see that speck in the sky?
That
is the London Out Loud drone. Mm. We're in Carlisle Street, we should say.
Yes, so we are on the corner of Dean Street and Carlisle Street. And it's sort of not accidental that we've stopped here, because one of the things that I wanted to talk about was food trends and influences. And I guess two of the big food trends at the moment, or influences, have come out of supper clubs, and we talked a little bit about that earlier, but also street food. Street food is really hugely influencing the development of restaurants and the dining scene in general. And you can sort of really see how things filter through from street food. And we'll visit Berwick Street Market shortly and have a little look at that and get a bit of a sense of the vibe down there. But through to influencing bricks and mortar restaurants.
Are you thinking of stuff like gourmet burgers?
I'm actually thinking more along the lines of, well, the reason we've stopped here is we're right out in front of Pizza Pilgrims. And Pizza Pilgrims started their life out, they had a van. On the back of the van, they built a wood-fired pizza oven. And they sold their pizzas from Berwick Street Market. And this is just because it was a couple of guys who were interested in making pizzas, and they'd been to Italy and got very sort of fascinated by it. And so they built such an amazing clientele that they actually sourced their finance for this bricks and mortar establishment through crowdfunding. So it's through the process of doing something on a really small scale, which is financially really manageable, that allows you then to sort of scale it up and do it in a more formalised setting. So when I say it's influencing, I think it's about people trialling out their concept and seeing whether or not it works, and then sort of scaling up. So there's another restaurant in Lexington Street called Bao, which is really difficult to get into. It's tiny. They do Korean bao buns, and that is again something that's sprung up out of street food. So perhaps burgers, but actually when I'm talking about it, I'm talking sort of that slightly more cutting edge, more innovative, more, you know, just testing out the concept and then taking it somewhere else.
So I should jump in and say, because I'm aware that there is in fact a company called Gourmet Burgers or something very similar to that. And I was using the term generically rather than specifically referring to any firm by that
name. Other burgers are available.
And I'm sure Gourmet Burgers are delicious.
Great burgers, terrific.
but it seems to me that that's a terrifically dangerous, really, move, risky, brave to invest in bricks and mortar, and particularly in a hot, expensive place like Soho.
Absolutely. But, you know, they've now got a number of different establishments, so they've got one in Kingly Court as well. So it's worked for them and it's paid off for them. But I'm sure that there are just as many small-scale vendors that trialled out their concept at a street food market and haven't gone anywhere with it or decided themselves not to go anywhere with it.
A quick word, I think, is necessary on the area in general because, of course, you'll know if you've been here that the place is under a massive transformation at the moment. Crossrail, the upgrade of Tottenham Court Road station, centre point entirely shrouded in scaffolding. As you come out of the station there, you're looking at the ruins of a lot of buildings that are being demolished or rebuilt. How long have you been doing this tour?
So I've been doing the tour for almost 2 years, and that doesn't sound like a very long period of time, but I've seen incredible shifts and changes in Soho in that time. And I think this sort of term gentrification really applies firmly to Soho at the moment. And I think, you know, it's organic. It's like, you know, a lot of places in the world, like New York, you know, there's a whole range of different places that have changed over a period of time. But for Soho to retain some of what is precious about it is, I mean, that's the thing that attracts people. It's the eclecticness of the nature of the place. It's the fact that it's a home for everyone, that really there are any number of different types of people and people with different types of lifestyles that come to the hub of Soho. And I think whilst developers will want to create penthouses and people will want to buy penthouses, I think someone somewhere has to be really careful not to squash that germ, that little pearl that is so fabulous about Soho.
There's a story we hear a lot in London, in all sorts of different areas. We are looking down Carlisle Street towards the Nadler, and there is the creature over the doorway would fit well in an Avengers movie, I think. Half angel, half dragonfly.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about her, actually, because I don't know whether you can see from here, but she actually has about 200 metal pins stuck into her. So I've not researched the background of that, but that distresses me.
Well, yes, that's very good point. In my unconscious, they were pigeon pins.
Okay.
But they're sticking out sideways as well, aren't they? No,
yeah,
I don't
they
think
are,
they can
rather.
Be.
Yeah, yeah. Now, she's the victim in that one. So let's just head left down Dean Street and continue along.
Well, I've always rather liked Soho in the sunshine. This brings out people into the cafe tables outside the buildings. And people are a little bit freer and easier. This is what I like in Soho in particular, is a chap who's making no effort to fit in with the alternative vibe. He's entirely done out in tweed, riding his upright bicycle.
Yes, I do love that. You get a bit of everyone and a bit of everything. Quentin, we're going to head down St Anne's Court. We're just going to cross over and not get run over. Yeah, so at the same time that he's in his tweed, there are lots of workmen around. There's a woman in a sleeping bag, puffing a fag. There's worker people.
Worker people.
Office worker people. Because, of course, Soho is the home to a lot of multimedia production houses, post-production houses. 20th Century Fox, of course, have got their head office in Soho Square.
I wonder if they regret being called 20th Century Fox.
Feeling a bit dated, huh? Zelman's Meats, which is a place that we're just walking past now. This is really interesting because it was originally set up last year as a seafood restaurant, which was called Rex and Mariano. And Rex and Mariano own the burger and lobster chain, and it was brilliant as a seafood restaurant, but it just didn't do the dollars for them. So, you know, they would do lots of things like ceviche, and when we're looking at sort of food trends and influences, a lot of the sort of South American style of cooking was filtering down into different establishments. But towards the end of last year, to outcry loud and clear from the food scene, they actually closed the seafood restaurant down, and they're focusing a lot on meat now. Now, I guess it remains to be seen as to whether or not this is successful for them, but their thinking was along the lines of the fact that Soho has got such a big lunchtime population. Those people weren't buying seafood meals in the middle of the day, but they might be inclined to have some of the Chateaubriand or some of the short ribs, or they've got a brisket sandwich and chips, so they're sort of trying to cover all those bases.
They've got a dirty steak.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't like the sound of that.
No, not for the Londonist audience,
no.
Quentin. Tidy steak, yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the gorgeous things about Soho streets is that they are very meandery. They are sort of little laneways, cobblestoned often, and these aren't cobblestones, but, you know, there's a lovely sense of history and sense of place when you're walking down some of the Soho streets.
There's a bit of that thing where you've got to know where you're going, and that's insider status that goes along with being familiar with the area.
I think that's right, actually. I mean, it's the same for wherever you go, I guess. But in Soho, it's particularly relevant, I think, because the laneways are so windy. We could duck down there, for instance, or we could continue along here. We might duck down there, but one of the things I did want to point out was at the end of this street, there is a very well-known bakery chain. And one of the things I think that's really interesting in terms of food trends at the moment is this desire that people have to connect with the people that are creating the food that they're eating, or the chocolate that they're nibbling on, or the craft beer that they're consuming. And I think, you know, when you think back to sort of the 15, 1600s, everything that we ate or drank was artisan produced. Because it had to be, because we really didn't have the means for mass production. Take us through the Industrial Revolution and we could create things like tinned Spam, for better or worse. But I think now people are really looking for that connection. You know, who's making the food that I'm eating? Now, not all the time, and obviously there's a premium on that sort of food because it is very small-scale production. But one of the things that I've noticed is that it really raises a bit of a moral dilemma, because the word artisan... When do you start and when do you stop using that word? There is a bakery chain which started out of an individual bakery. It's expanded now, and they don't bake the bread on the premises. They bake it in a factory and then they drive it in. Their banner on the side of their building says Artisan Bakery. You know, there's a lot in words, and because what does artisan really mean?
Yes, I can think of another bakery exactly the same thing, and their prices would suggest that there are people crafting each individual loaf with love and affection.
Yeah, love and affection, yeah. And it's scooped past this place, and when you look in the window, it's very carefully been crafted such that you might think, if you were a visitor to London, that it really was an individual bakery with, you know, someone downstairs rolling out little loaves and making cakes.
But this is nothing new, is it? If you think about the pub scene and some of those big pub chains, and each one is designed to, you know, just have a few local twists and a little bit of a flavour of the area, but actually it's part of some big pub company and the landlord is unable to make any money.
Of course it's the same thing, but it doesn't mean it's right. I mean, they probably wouldn't call themselves a boutique brewery, but, you know, along those lines there'd be something that creates that sense, because that's what they know, that's what we as consumers are looking for. We're looking for this individual connection with what we're eating or drinking. And, you know, a bakery which calls itself artisan suggests that it is small-scale production.
Well, I think for balance, we've got to acknowledge that any inference we're making about the provenance of these hot cross buns, for example, is entirely in our own heads, and I'm sure they're not claiming anything that isn't true.
Now, we're going to walk across the road, and we're going to walk past a chocolatier, which is an artisan chocolatier, who does make all of his chocolates in the basement.
Crossing over the road now. When did you see your first hot cross bun, by the way?
Oh, dear. I've been a hot cross bun lover for a very long time.
No, I don't mean in your life. I mean in the annual cycle.
Oh, heavens above.
a weird question. Like, I mean, yeah, it was a weird question, anyway.
I did think it was an odd question. Okay, but okay. I think I saw them. It was probably January when I saw them out in supermarkets.
Yeah, I think I've got the same.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I clocked one before Christmas.
Really? Oh, yeah. That's wrong. That's just all wrong.
Listener, have a look at my Twitter feed if you dare at N. Quentin Wolf, and I tweeted one. It must have been around Christmas time because I tweeted season's greetings.
That's wrong. That's just all wrong. Mm. Let's go inside to this fabulous chocolate shop, and of course the listeners can't take a big deep breath in, but Quentin, I would encourage you to. It's gorgeous.
Okay, here we go. Good grief, I think I'm drunk.
That's fine.
Well, the nostril is currently full of rose. There's lots of subtle liqueur-y fragrances going on. Of course, cocoa. Oh, wonderful. Well, that's the podcast over. I'm staying here.
So we are now in the fabulous boutique chocolatier store in Wardour Street of Paul A. Young. And Paul A. Young is one of London's most renowned chocolatiers. He's actually won, his chocolate truffle has won the World Chocolate Awards three times, gold medal three times. He's now disqualified because he's actually one of the judges, but that's the only reason. So this place is particularly special because I think in contrast to what we were talking about earlier, Quentin, around artists and etc. and what makes it acceptable term to use, these guys make all of these truffles downstairs in the kitchen. Now they only have a slab of marble for tempering, a stove top for warming the chocolate, and some moulds. Everything is done by hand. The packaging is also done by hand, and all of the different decorations done by hand. They have no preservatives and no additives in them, and so they only last for 7 days. Quite impressive that's the level of labour and love that goes into creating these fantastic chocolates.
It does strike me that there are no prices on view.
Yeah. Well, the more you buy, the cheaper it is. But they are expensive.
What would you pay for a truffle?
£2 per truffle, with a reduction as you get a larger box. But the thing is, and I would love to get you to try one of the sea-salted caramel chocolates, if you must. Because the thing is, you could have, let's think about it, for £2.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Could probably three Mars bars at a supermarket, and I guarantee that you put this in your mouth and you squash down on it and you won't need another one. So can you bear with me while I get one for you?
You're going to do that?
Yeah.
I'm liking this door even more.
Can I get just one sea salt or caramel?
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Just all in one because it's quite runny.
All in one. Yeah. In we go.
Okay. So while Quentin's crunching down on that, the recommendation was to bite into it in one go because it has a delicious, silky, buttery, caramelized filling, which is very liquidy. So it's encased by a beautiful 70% dark chocolate, but it's not super... Sometimes dark chocolate can actually sort of stick to the roof of your mouth. It's not super sort of pull your lips in. And then the sweetness of the caramel, the liquid caramel, is just the most magical marriage in my view. But over to you, Quinton, what do you think?
Well, I've been transported to another place.
Excellent.
Yeah, that really does take things to a whole other level. I don't know if I'm imagining this, but I really do feel like the purity of the flavours is something that is coming through.
Mm.
I think delightful is the word I'm looking for.
It is delightful. It absolutely is delightful. And so, you know, what I try to convey to people is that the level of passion, the level of labour that goes into creating that one tiny truffle is worth £2. Because for me...
Are you on a commission?
Not at all, actually. I pay for all of the food that I consume and that my guests on my tour consume. I love embracing people that are doing the thing that they do, really, because, you know, Paul A. Young could make a lot of money cutting corners, but he doesn't. You know, he creates this amazing experience for you, for me, you know, for us, and I think that really needs to be applauded. Oh, I sound a bit religious now, don't
I? You do, yeah. The zeal of the convert.
Exactly, indeed.
We better get out of here before we decide to stay. Well, the cascade of deliciousness is still with me. I might take this opportunity to throw a break in. I'll be savouring. Meanwhile, here's a very important message.
The Sound of London. Londonist Out Loud with N. Quentin Wolfe. Listen free every week on your favourite podcast platform. Subscribe via iTunes and get great extra content at londonist.com. Tweet the show at Londonist Sound and see pictures of all our guests on the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
You are listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and with me is Michelle Francis, and we're on a food tour of Soho. And we've just turned into the cobbles of Berwick Street Market. We can see the Pan-Asian pit stop booth at the end here, and an assortment of glamorous bags on the next stall along, fruit and veg further down. And I've heard a lot about Berwick Street Market, and I think I've been down here a few times without really clocking it properly.
Yeah. So Berwick Street Market is actually the oldest market in London. It was established about 200 years ago, and it's actually where the very first tomato came in 1880, and then sort of 10 years on, the very first grapefruit.
Can I just challenge you for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
200, I don't really believe that the oldest market in London would be only 200 years old.
Okay, I'll send you references, Clinton.
Listener, what do you think about this? I don't know. I'd like to have a huddle and discuss this, really.
All right.
Let's... 200 years doesn't seem remotely long enough.
Well, okay, let's bring in the listeners.
Yes, okay, yes. If you have a view on this, please make contact via the usual means. Berwick Street Market, possibly the oldest market in London.
Possibly. But so, Berwick Street Market, it is actually in the process. It's a really good example of an area of Soho that is in a huge process of gentrification. So when we look down here, Quinton, you'll see that on the right-hand side, there's a whole board of hoardings and scaffolding. And that's actually where they're taking down a lot of what was council housing, and they're converting it into penthouse housing.
Converting it into something nobody can afford.
Yes, exactly, absolutely.
Turning it from useful housing into investment.
Yeah, that's quite right. So I think it really will change the fabric of the area. You can also see there's a little duck there on a sign. That's actually the home of the duck and rice, which is one of... So people in the foodie world would be familiar with Alan Yao, who's really one of... Well, I call him one of my sort of Soho foodie identities. He's certainly picked up a lot of different establishments and really changed the feel of eating. He took this place, which was the Endurance Pub, one of London's sort of older, more established sticky carpet pubs, and he's turned it into what he calls a Chinese gastropub. Now, we'll walk past it and you'll see that there are some fantastic copper vats of beer, boutique beer. But again, it's really catering to a much higher sort of end market. But
reflection on that is that we've got really comfortable with the idea of Thai food being mixed in with pubs. That seems to be ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. It surprises me to realise that Chinese food, much less so. Why would that be?
I think that Chinese food and alcohol is tricky. So Thai food, you tend to have beer associated more with Thai food. I think Chinese food less so. I mean, Alan Yao has certainly, he's pushed the boundaries very consistently throughout his career, and this was one of the things that he just had in his mind that he really wanted to do. I think it's a really good observation, though.
I mean, is it just that we're terrifically set in our ways to that extent? For example, you'd have no problem ordering a super hot curry and quaffing a few lagers with it. There's no reason at all why we shouldn't have gone down that other path.
Well, I guess not, but I mean, we've had a much longer, more established tradition of eating Indian food, given the Raj period and the East India Company. And we've had a lot longer period, I think, also with Thai food from the sort of the 60s explorers. And I don't know how many people travelled to China, and, you know, our version of what Chinese food is very manufactured. It's a very boarded sort of concept, I think.
Just on the subject of international travel, being as you're an international traveller, is there a place where you can eat? I mean, I don't know what I'd even think of apart from barbecues when I think of Australian cuisine.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is lots that is simply not coming to mind, but are there Australian dining establishments around?
Yeah. So Australian food itself as a cuisine is really, it's not well known. And I think that, you know, you've said it yourself, you think of barbecue, you think of, you know, throw a shrimp on the barbie. You know, occasionally people go off onto a tangent of thinking about kangaroo meat. But actually what I think of and what I've realised now, actually not living in Australia, is Australian food is, we have a much more organic sense of fusion food. So we marry a lot of very good quality ingredients with a lot of Southeast Asian techniques, food techniques, and also ingredients. So, and we do it in a much more, and when I say organic, what I mean is that quite often if you get fusion food that's made elsewhere, it can feel very contrived. It can feel very much like here's a potato and let's put a bit of lemongrass with that potato and there's fusion food. And I think Australian food,
I'm not eating there, wherever that is.
I do think that Australian food, because we're so close to Southeast Asia and we had a huge influx of immigrants, particularly from Vietnam, we do that sort of Asian fusion food a lot better. So one place that I think does that brilliantly here in London is Granger & Co. So there's a couple of outlets. There's one in Granary Square in King's Cross, and there's another one in Notting Hill and another one in Clerkenwell. And that's a guy, Bill Granger, who came over probably actually around the time that I moved over. No connection there, and I just feel lazy having not done nearly as much as he's done in that time. But yeah, he does that really, really, really well. So he'll do an Asian slaw with a chicken schnitzel, you know, nothing radical, but just really lovely, gentle, and again, focus being on really good quality fresh ingredients, because we do get access to that a lot more frequently than here.
Yeah, and I can kind of imagine that resulting in a fresh style, mm-hmm. as well as fresh,
yes.
flavours.
I think that's right. So I think there's definitely a zinginess about Australian food when it's done well. There's a freshness, there's a liveliness, there's a piquancy to Australian food that you don't find necessarily in other cuisines.
No, absolutely, and particularly not perhaps in British cuisine, which I think is still making a good fist of it, but still working hard to shrug off the idea of boiling everything to death.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, when I first came to London for a visit about 20 years ago, I didn't think there was any way in the world I would ever live here, because I didn't think I'd be able to eat anything. It was awful, absolutely awful. It was chips, it was mashed potato. I mean, I was on a budget too. I was a student, so it probably affected things. But I think now the food scene in London is so diverse and so eclectic and so lively. It's brilliant. But I do think there's still a ways to go.
Shall we head off intrepidly down Berwick Street?
Of course, just throwing back to earlier in the program, we talked a little bit about some of the street food that has sprung up from Berwick Street Market. We talked a bit about the Pizza Pilgrim Boys, whose business has sprung up from a van with a wood-fired pizza on the back of it, selling their pizza through Berwick Street. And there's been many other different establishments that have popped up from testing themselves at the water at Berwick Street Market. Today there's a mix of different food places, as well as some fabric shops and flower stalls. It's the sort of place that actually doesn't translate very well on the weekends, though, unfortunately, because a lot of the food elements of Berwick Street Market are really here, existing for the office staff, office workers. We're just about to pass Soho Dairy, which is another brilliant little start-up, I guess you'd say. They are really intent on bringing in fresh milk from the countryside and offering an alternative to supermarket milks.
Glancing at the tortillas on the next stall, there are some examples plated up. They look absolutely delicious.
This looks rather gorgeous, Quentin. You can see the beautiful butter just bubbling up there.
This is a large pan and it's all fluffing up. This is a fluffy tortilla.
It's a fluffy tortilla, exactly.
I can see we've got tortilla with black pudding and possibly red pepper in there.
So, Quentin, as you can see, this is the sort of food that you don't... I mean, whilst we eat a lot of tapas food, it is the sort of food that you wouldn't necessarily find in a restaurant on its own, all these different types of tortilla, and they're very reasonably priced. So £4 for a plain tortilla and £5 for a filled one.
We have some of the flamboyancy of Soho that we're passing now, costumes, incense sticks. A lot of material shops down here, actually.
Yeah, so this has traditionally been a bit of a fabric hood, and a lot of these places have now been pushed out from... They had their shops at the basement of this big apartment building, which is, as we were talking about, is being reconstructed now for penthouse living. A lot of these hardware stores, again, they actually had little shops, and then now they've just got a stall on the street. This is one of my favourite street food places here. They do their own falafel, so it's called Jerusalem Kitchen. They make their own...
Our arch enemy has arrived. This is the trolley moving over cobbles.
Okay. We're trying to... Yeah, okay. So they make their own bread for the falafel. They make their own falafel, obviously, as you would expect. They cook off their aubergine. And just the level of purity in the food is phenomenal. And I don't even like falafels. And I really, really, I love these guys. And they make all their own... It doesn't matter, thank you.
What they make there must remain forever a mystery.
Oh, you're a dear. Thank you.
Now, I should explain what's just happened here. A man has just rushed up in a fashion that would normally be alarming in Soho, and he's thrust an object into Michelle's hand.
A long, thin, wrapped object.
I would run a mile.
Let's not get into any more definition around that. All my adjectives have gone from me. But where we are standing, though, Quentin,
you can't leave me in that level of mystery.
Haven't I? So this is a...
It's about 12 inches long.
Yeah. And rather...
Discreetly
sturdy.
Wrapped.
Mm.
Yes.
So we have actually been given a falafel from the Jerusalem Kitchen.
Do they know you?
No, they don't. They're not even on my walk. But this is purely from a genuine recommendation from me, because I do love the way they do their falafels. And I know you're sort of probably thinking, well, a falafel, shalafel, they're all the same. But when you have someone who makes their own bread and then makes their own hummus and then makes their own pickles and then they make their own actual balls of falafels, and it's not a mix and they're not just adding water and making them into balls, what you're eating tastes different.
And no, absolutely. There's an Italian restaurant just around the corner from here where I learnt this lesson, that it has very little to do with the name of the ingredients. It's to do with the quality of the ingredients, and you can keep it exceptionally simple and put two or three piece of cheese, piece of bread, a bit of asparagus, and it can blow your mind if the ingredients are delicious and well sourced.
Yeah, very true. I absolutely believe that, and I think it's really interesting because one of the other trends that are happening a bit at the moment, and it sort of harks back to the Jerusalem falafel kitchen there, it's around Middle Eastern food. And when you think about the best Middle Eastern food, it really is the simplicity of it. It really is it paired back and cooked in a really, really simple way. And I do think that Britain is having a bit of a flirtation with Middle Eastern food at the moment. A lot of it can be credited to Yota Mottolenghi, who has really sort of launched, I guess it's a familiarity with Middle Eastern food as a cuisine that's beyond a falafel. So where you might get some of the ingredients and use them in, you might find Middle Eastern ingredients now popping up in gastro pubs. So you'll find pomegranate molasses and sumac and dukkha and other different ingredients, but they're not necessarily being done in a purist sense, just coming back to our earlier conversation around fusion. But I do think that's shifted when you look at old style British food 10, 15, 20 years ago, the melding of different ethnicities into an overall food pot has come a really long way.
What about, and I'm asking this with the place in mind that we were talking about earlier on, where they've had to shift their menu quite substantially, what about the loyalty to particular kinds of cuisine in a world where in most areas we want something new and we want it yesterday? Do particular kinds of food stick around for very long? Different kinds of dining, are they? Is it a fast turnover of styles?
I think there is definitely something very faddish in the food world. You know, it really is the new shiny bauble that everyone runs after. And I think that because the world of blogging has become so huge, and those bloggers and those Instagrammers and those social media fanatics, they're all looking for something new. So I think definitely people are looking for the next thing. But I also think at the same time that if an eatery does something really, really well, it will retain its following. There's a seafood restaurant around the corner from here in Brewer Street, which has been there for 20 years. And with the rents of Soho and with the change of demographics within Soho and with the fickleness of eaters, it's quite remarkable that they've been able to stay there for that long. And yet, they are chock-a-block and you really have to queue up to get in. So there is a bit of both of those things going on, I think.
And what's their strategy? Is it adapt and survive or stay the same and establish yourself
out? I think it's do what we do well. So their thing is seafood. They've got a fantastic turnover. They bring it all in very fresh. They do offer some non-seafoody elements, but none of it's very adventurous. None of it's very radical. They just do it particularly well. It is lovely. And their vibe, the environs are very Soho. So, you know, there's a massive mirror ball in the middle of the restaurant. It's actually an old French butchery. You're going to correct me on this, but it was allegedly
the first ever French butchery
in 1908. But let's see whether your listeners will be able to correct that. But that's what I'm led to believe. And so they've still got a lot of the old bits and pieces, paraphernalia from its life as a butchery, as well as melding it with life in 2016. So they've got this huge mirror ball, which is just fantastic, and a gorgeous bar, and yeah. So I think in that instance, it's a small space, so they'd probably do maybe 30 covers. So that their rent is probably quite high, but they are very established, and they really do, you know, continue to do what they're doing really, really well. I think that's their answer. It's not everyone's, but that is their answer.
We could continue to enjoy what you're doing very, very well, but we're pretty much out of time already, which has gone incredibly fast. And like a good meal, no, does this work with food? I was about to say you should leave the diner wanting more, but that's probably the one area where you really shouldn't.
Yeah, no. Leave the diner stuffed. So we'll have to come back again.
Well, it sounds good to me. And in the meanwhile, if people want to find you and be and accompany you around Soho, how would they go about doing so?
Well, I'd be delighted if that was the case. They could check out my website, which is... has this noise just started up because I'm about to promote myself? no, my website... which is London from scratch, or one word, .co.uk. And I do Soho food tours, and I also do Marylebone food tours. So I'd be delighted if anyone wanted to come along with me, because it is something that I do.
The question is, will the quality of the falafel compensate for
yes.
that intrusion on the show? I think it will.
Yeah. It's a pretty good one. Oh. I'll share it with you, Quinton. Actually, I'll give it to you. or is that bad? Is that sort of...
I don't know, yeah. You know, there's an ethical dilemma to be...
exposure or something.
Should we solve the ethical dilemma off air?
Yeah, yes. Indeed. All right.
Michelle Francis, thanks very much.
Thanks, Quinton.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one could have left you with your name.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Michelle Francis. Thanks to Yannick Pucci and Bernie Barclay. theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Ian Quentin Wolfe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.